Welcome to The Rest is History, and we kick off today's episode, the final episode of our London Week, with very, very sad news, Tom.
Yeah. We've been sitting by the phone, haven't we?
Two episodes ago, we ended on a cliffhanger. Well, waiting to discover whether Netflix or some other streaming giant would take us up on our suggestion of a TV series, a best-selling blockbuster TV series, based on the life of Henry Fielding and his brother John and the Bow Street Runners, with future possible spin-offs involving Dr. Johnson hunting ghosts. I regret to say, Tom,
they have stared a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah, they've foolishly thrown away the chance. So we'll be offering it to Amazon starting from now. In the meantime, we are sticking with the podcasting lark. So that's good news for some, bad news for people who don't like the podcast, but why would they be listening? So we are going to finish off our London week. We've done the walk around Smithfield with the ill-fitting shoes. We did London People. We had C.L.R. James and Henry Fielding. We had London Places. We had the Two Eyes Coffee Bar, and we had Barking Abbey. And if you've been with us since the start of the week, you'll remember that we did our walk around Roman London. And we're going to end by each choosing a London moment, a kind of a cultural moment or a political moment. It could be anything. So I've got mine, and Tom, I think you're going to go first, aren't you?
Yeah, because mine is chronologically first.
Yeah.
And we're going back to the 13th century, the reign of Henry III, who's the son of King John, father of Edward I. And we're going to 1252, which is the year in which Henry III was given by Hakon the Young, who was the king of Norway, a gift, and that gift was a polar bear.
Ooh.
So this polar bear had come because Hakon the Young, as a Norwegian, had trade links with Iceland, and Iceland had links with Greenland, and so there were polar bears that were able to be sourced.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a very classy gift, because not many kings in medieval Europe had a polar bear. So this polar bear was kept in the tower, in the Tower of London. It had to wear a kind of a collar and a chain to stop it from running off.
Right.
But its keepers would very kindly allow it to swim in the Thames and hunt fish.
Wow.
So it would jump into the Thames and
But it's unseasonably
around.
Warm for a polar bear. More intolerable.
Yeah, I think
warm.
The temperatures were quite a bit colder then, weren't they? I mean, they had kind of chilly winters and things.
I suppose so.
Because it's the start of a kind of ice age period, mini ice age, that will finish off the Viking settlements in Greenland.
In Greenland,
so it's
starting
to happen at this point. So
yes.
So perhaps the polar bear was all right. I mean, I agree. I don't think it was great. And the polar bear was not alone. So this is about animals that were kept in the Tower of London.
Okay.
So the Tower of London was the closest thing that London had to a zoo.
Because it's famous as a menagerie, isn't it? Is this when the menagerie is founded?
No. So it begins in 1235 when Frederick II, you know, remarkable emperor, Stupormundi, one of the kind of the most charismatic and remarkable figures of medieval history, would well merit an episode.
Yeah.
His sister, Eleanor of Provence, is marrying Henry III. And so what do you give the King of England? You give him three lions.
Ooh.
Three lions on the shirt. Well, actually, they're leopards. They're leopards.
Are they already a symbol of England at this point?
They are. So
right.
This is why he gives them.
Yeah.
So they're either leopards or lions. They're probably lions, but there's some confusion. So these lions are kept in the Tower of London. And then you get the polar bear. So that gets added. And then in 1255, so that's 3 years after the polar bear has arrived, Louis IX of France sends Henry III an elephant.
An elephant?
And the elephant has its own house, so that's nice. But what's not so nice for the elephant is that scholars in Henry III's court think that elephants don't drink water. So
they think such a stupid thing?
They just give it wine. So the poor elephant is permanently drunk.
A drunken elephant. God, trumpeting, no doubt, at all hours, yeah.
So it's very badly behaved. And doesn't live very long.
No surprise there. So where's the King of France got the elephant from?
I'm not sure. I would guess from India, so from the Caliphate.
Yeah.
That's how, because you remember that Harun al-Rashid, the great Abbasid caliph, gives an elephant to Charlemagne. So that must have come via India.
So there must be an elephant well established, yeah.
But this is the first elephant to arrive in England since the time of the Romans.
Hold on. Since the time of the Romans? Do we know the Romans had elephants?
It's claimed that Caesar brought an elephant.
Why would he bother?
Why would he bother? So that's perhaps not entirely. And it seems that Claudius rode into Colchester on an elephant. So they brought one over to impress the locals.
That seems just immensely implausible to me. Don't you think?
No, I like to think that that's what happened.
Okay. Okay. You debunk when it suits you. And then when it doesn't suit you, you...
The Romans definitely had access to elephants.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure at some point there are elephants in.
I don't believe anybody has ever ridden into Colchester on an elephant.
Well, you and your scepticism. But this establishes the idea that a king should properly have animals, wild animals, exotic animals. Yeah. And Edward I, who is Henry III's son, he basically creates kind of permanent facilities for this menagerie. And it's a tower that is now demolished, that was just beyond the drawbridge. And because it had lions, it was called the Lion Tower. And this tradition of keeping animals there lasted throughout the Middle Ages, through the Tudor period, into the Stuart period. So James I is very keen on it. So when he comes down from Scotland, he loves the fact that he owns a menagerie. So he improves it. James I refurbishes the setting so that people can actually come and watch the lions prowl around and drink and eat and things like that. So it's a bit like a zoo.
That's a zoo. I mean,
it's starting to turn into a zoo. And so there are lions there, there are leopards, there are eagles, there are pumas, there's a tiger, and there's a jackal. So James loves everything that London offers, all the kind of stuff that he hadn't been able to get in Scotland. And absolutely, a menagerie is part of it.
But no more polar bears, Tom, surely.
No more polar bears. And so this menagerie lasts through into the 18th century, but it's starting to become a bit kind of scuffy. And into the 19th century, 1824, the RSPCA is founded, well before you get any charities devoted to ending cruelty to children, for instance.
Well, I mean, the British famously care more about dogs than humans.
So much more concerned with animals. And in 1826, do you know who is Constable of the Tower of London?
Is it Duke of Wellington?
It is the Duke of Wellington. How did you know that?
I've just been secretly reading up on it.
Dominic, that's cheating. That's cheating.
I know, it is.
Anyway,
cheating.
So he basically decides that you know, the Tower of London is not a place for animals.
And
so
that's odd for the Duke of Wellington because he's so reactionary.
Well, on this occasion, he is looking to the future. And so he sends it off to the newly built Regent's Park. So they've been built this great park at the end of Regent Street. Built by the Prince Regent, and this is a much better place for the Duke of Wellington decides for animals. And so 150 of them get sent there. And then in 1828, a zoo opens, so London Zoo opens in Regent's Park.
Yeah.
And 7 years later, the menagerie gets closed for good. So all the animals are cleared out of the Tower of London and it stops. You know, that's the end. It's very sad. So that's the history of the menagerie in the Tower of London. But there's one intriguing further detail. So we have, one of the themes of this week has been ghosts.
Yeah.
So we mentioned the Cock Lane ghost, the ghost of Prior Aher in St. Bartholomew's, lots of ghosts.
The ghost of Skiffle.
The ghost of Skiffle. But in 1816, a century, so I assume would it be a beefeater? A guard of the Tower of London.
I guess it might be, yeah.
Anyway, he is standing by where the crown jewels are kept. And suddenly he sees looming from out of the door that leads into the jewel room. He sees the figure of an enormous bear. An enormous bear. And so he raises his bayonet to try and stop it. And the bear just goes straight through the bayonet, through him, and vanishes. And the guard, the beefeater, collapses. Comes to, says what he's seen. Obviously, they assume he's drunk.
Yeah.
So they fetch the doctor.
Elephant.
The elephant. So the doctor confirms that he wasn't drunk, and the poor man dies shortly afterwards.
Of fright.
Of shock, of terror. So what was this ghost? What was the ghost of the bear? Could it have been the polar bear, perhaps? Maybe. Who knows? Or could it have been the ghost of a bear that had been given to George III by the Hudson Bay Company. And George III was very disappointed with this bear because he'd wanted clothes, you know, because the Hudson Bay Company produced.
He wanted like
amazing,
fur, a nice fur coat, or something.
Nice fur coat or hat or something like that. Yeah. So he's very disappointed. He got a bear that was called Old Martin and was very, very grumpy. Right. So that was kept in the Tower of London. So maybe it was the ghost of Old Martin. But it has been argued by London parapsychologists that perhaps this was the ghost of a bear that had lived in the Thames estuary way back when Britain was home to bears and other such wild animals, so lions and mammoths and
things like
that.
You don't really tend to get prehistoric ghosts, though, do you? I think that's the most
implausible. Are you a leading London parapsychologist, Dominic?
No, but
well,
I think...
Your scepticism is out of control. Rein it in.
Yeah.
You've scoffed at the idea that the Emperor Claudius rode on an elephant into Colchester.
I have scoffed at
and
that.
And now you're scoffing at the idea that the ghost seen in the Tower of London might be the ghost of an ancient cave bear or something like that.
I think
who knows, Dominic? We don't know. It's a mystery.
It sounds like it's the ghost of Old Martin. That's my theory.
That's what you're going for.
So sometimes in this podcast, we like to address historical mysteries. We've done the Princes in the Tower. Richard III did it. And I'm going to put my neck on the line again and say, I think this is the ghost of Old Martin because the polar bear, I don't see what motive the polar bear has for haunting.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right because also the signal thing about a polar bear is that it's white. And this is not mentioned.
Yeah, he would have said. It was a ghost of a white bear. Unless, I suppose, the ghosts tend to be white anyway.
No, only so Scooby-Doo.
I don't know. Do you know who would resolve this?
Who?
Dr. Johnson Ghost Hunter.
Yes, he would. He would. So Amazon. Again, so if anyone from Amazon is listening to this.
TV producers, please do not ignore this brilliant idea. Right.
Anyway, so that's my choice.
That's great. So our next moment, which we'll do after the break, is much less TV. Well, although there has been a TV program about it. Yeah. That's tantalising.
Okay. That's we'll come exciting. Back after the break and find out what Dominic's got for you. We'll see you then.
See you then.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. The very last section of our London week. And today we are looking at events or episodes that have happened in the history of the British capital. We've had Henry III being given a polar bear in the first half. That was my choice. And now, Dominic, what's your choice?
Well, Tom, we've had a lot in this week about people coming to London, about people moving to London, about people bringing bears to London, or elephants or whatever they might be, baboons or lions or whatever. So I thought we'd end by people getting out of London. So you will no doubt know, as a top Londoner, what was the world's first underground railway? Do you know?
I do, Metropolitan Line.
It was the Metropolitan Line. So the Metropolitan Line opens in 1863, has gas-lit wooden carriages, and it's hauled by steam locomotives. And
it's the setting for a Sherlock Holmes story, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. And it's sort of very much redolent of that sort of Holmesian London.
Yeah.
But also London, you know, in the era just after the Great Exhibition. So London, when it's the absolute sort of
imperial,
it's the world's, yeah, it's the world's metropolis. Exactly. So the Metropolitan Railway, as it was then called, as you said, it goes from basically the city to Baker Street, Paddington. But then they start extending it very quickly. So by 1864, it has reached Hammersmith in West London. By 1877, it has reached Richmond. And then the line starts to go out north into the sort of countryside of what's then Middlesex. So it goes to Harrow in 1880, Winston Churchill's old school. And eventually, it gets as far as a place called Verney Junction in Buckinghamshire. So at that point, what we now think of as part of the London tube system, or part of the London underground system, it extends more than 50 miles out of London to the northwest, all the way into rural, very rural Buckinghamshire. So if you think about the map, especially for people who are from overseas, who aren't massively familiar with London's public transport system, you have this artery going out of London northwest into what are called the home counties. So this is sort of affluent, semi-rural England, southern England, so the counties of Middlesex, Hertfordshire, and Buckinghamshire. So the line goes out.
People playing tennis, isn't it, and stockbrokers. And
exactly. Well, we'll come to how they start doing all that, because the Metropolitan Railway doesn't just have the land around the railway. It's been allowed, it's legislation setting it up has allowed it to keep land, to buy and keep land that it thinks it may use later. So it's basically accumulated much more land than it needs. And that's running along this railway. And they start to think, well, how can we make this, because it's a private company, how can we, you know, basically get all this land to turn us a pretty profit? And the obvious way is to build housing. So with the development of the railways, you have the development of commuting. So people are coming into town on the railway and working in London, then going back out to the countryside. Obviously,
is this the first time it's happened in the world, do you think, something like this? Is this another London first?
I think it probably is, Tom, because where else will you have, I mean, I suppose at roughly the same period, you would have had people commuting into Paris
and maybe New York.
Yeah, or maybe commuting into New York or major cities in Germany.
So you get the sense with all this that it is something new.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, it is new. And the Metropolitan, and it's driven, it's both driven by demand, but also by supply. So the Metropolitan Railway kind of directors, they absolutely want to, they have this land, which they've held on to, and they want people to live in it, to build, they want to build houses on it, people to live there and to take their railway, and they will basically make loads of money. So they set up a company to start what they call their Surplus Lands Committee, to start building estates, housing estates. So late Victorian, Edwardian housing estates. So the first one is built in Pinner in sort of northwest London in 1900. And the people who are running the line, the Metropolitan line, are thinking all the time about how to encourage custom. So what they want to do is they want to get people to use their railway. So not just people coming into London, but people in London to use their railway to go out of London. And they want to kind of sell them the area on either side of the railway, to sell the beauty of it and the benefits of it, so that they will buy houses there. And then they'll be dependent on their railway for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, brilliant.
So they start producing. They have their own. I mean, it seems a weird thing for a, I mean, certainly would have seemed a weird thing at the time for a railway line to do. They have their own publicity department. They produce leaflets and posters, and particularly from about, I think it's 1908 or so, something round about then anyway, Edwardian period, they produce a booklet, a guide to the extension line, as they call it. And that guide is basically a guidebook. It tells you where to stay. This pub does a lovely pie. There's a lovely walk here, some nice woods. Get off at, you know, Chesham or whatever, or Amersham or any of these sort of places. Have a stroll around. Isn't it lovely? And maybe you could buy a house.
Yes.
And it's obviously going to be a hit, because it's sort of complete. It taps into the sort of zeitgeist of the Edwardian era, which is a huge growth of suburbs, growth of, you know, people becoming richer and richer, more affluent, middle classes, and so on. But also this fascination with the countryside and with this sort of vanishing.
And this is kind of merchant ivory film land.
Sort of, yes, I suppose so.
Tennis courts. White linen suits.
Well, that's the sort of the dream that they're selling you, basically, that you'll have your own little version of that. And the real moment that I want to sort of focus on is in 1915, because it's been delayed because of the war. But in 1915, they rename their guidebook. So it was the Guide to the Extension Line, and they call it the Guide to Metro Land. Mm. And that term, Metro Land, is coined in 1915, and it immediately becomes. It doesn't just, the thing that's interesting about it is it doesn't just refer to that area running into the Home Counties out of the northwest of London, but it becomes absolutely redolent of a cultural kind of atmosphere and a sort of political and economic atmosphere. So the Metroland guidebook, and you can get them, you can find bits of them online. They're selling you the joys of nature and all the lovely woods. You know, it sort of says at one point, it's sort of the Chiltern Hills are part of it. So it says at one point, each lover of Metroland may well have his own favourite wood, beech, and coppice, all tremulous, green, loveless in spring, and russet and gold in October. So this is obviously aimed at Londoners come out, you'll have your own favourite wood, you get the train.
Day go off take and have, on smog.
All exactly. Kind of yeah. All of this. And what they're selling you is this kind of Arcadia. So it's the same Arcadia in some ways that you see in The Wind in the Willows, that you see in, I don't know, the poetry of Edward Thomas or something, his poem Adlestrop, in which, of course, he gets off the train, or he's on the train in Gloucestershire, and he sees the birds singing and all that stuff. It's the Arcadia that you get the same period Tolkien is writing The Hobbit, and then later The Lord of the Rings. This sort of idealized rural England that is consumed
by... A kind of escape from the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly, by urban people.
Made possible by the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly that. So in a weird way, you could say it was kind of Disneyland rural England that is being created. But they also want to sell the houses. So as soon as they produced the booklet, they really start buying up more land. They buy it. It starts in places that now, to a lot of our listeners who know London or who know England, will sound incredibly humdrum. So Wembley, Rickmansworth, Neasden in particular. Neasden becomes a great symbol of this.
Joke, doesn't it? Yeah.
So these things that are kind of a joke because they're seen as quintessentially kind of banal and suburban. But if you go to those places, if you get the Metropolitan Line, get off, the houses, lots of kind of Tudor-Bethan houses. So they're built in, let's say, the 1920s in this deliberately retro kind of cottagey style. And they are sold to people as this is your own little country villa. This is your own little country house. So you've got a kind of bay window and you've got the steep roof and all that sort of stuff. A short stroll will take you to the lovely park. There's a golf course. There may be an Art Deco cinema built in the 1920s or the 1930s on the high street at the place where you're going. So it's this sort of world of, it's aspirational. It is suburban. It's sort of genteel. The houses are all called things like the Laurels or the Oaks and things like that. And actually what it becomes, what Metroland also becomes redolent of, very much a friend of the show, Tom, Stanley Baldwin. Baldwin's Britain. So 1920s, 1930s Britain. Because Baldwin's most famous speech is when he gave this 1924, so the peak of Metroland, he gives this speech saying, "To me, England is the country, and the country is England. When I ask myself what I mean by England, what I think of England when I'm abroad," and he goes on, blah, 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 what he thinks of is the sounds of England, the tinkle of the hammer on the anvil in the country smithy, the corncrake on a dewy morning, the sound of the scythe against the whetstone, and the sight of a plough team coming over the brow of a hill, the sight that has been England since England was a land.
And always will be.
Yeah, but the one eternal sight of England, he says. And the thing is that even as he's saying this in the 1920s, it's utterly faded and it's gone. But he is saying it to, I mean, his audience, his electorate, are the people who live in those houses.
Yeah.
So sort of nuclear families who are upwardly mobile, who have bought new houses on the estates, basically built and provided by the Metropolitan Railway.
But this is one of the great housing booms, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Lots of people, probably even listening to this podcast, without really thinking about it, are actually living in Stanley Baldwin's Britain. They're living in Metroland. They're living in 1920s, or houses built between the Edwardian period and the Second World War.
Yeah.
All those sort of suburban ribbon developments.
And then after the war, you have Betjeman's.
So what happens, Tom, is that the phrase Metroland becomes very nationally known very quickly. So in Evelyn Waugh's books, there's a character who marries Viscount Metroland. She becomes Lady Metroland in kind of Vile Bodies.
Is it starting to become a joke then?
Well, it is a joke to intellectuals. And it's always a joke to intellectuals. So
sneery metropolitan type.
Sneery, exactly. So if you've read, I think we've mentioned it before on this podcast, John Carey's book, The Intellectuals and the Masses, which is all about the kind of intellectual turn against the masses at the beginning of the 20th century. What all the things they dislike about the masses, suburbs, the Art Deco cinemas, the golf courses, all of those things that actually people like, they are emblematic of Metroland and they're emblematic of everything that intellectuals, writers, avant-gardists, Virginia Woolfists, people of that kind hate. And so Metroland does exactly that, become a bit of a sort of a punching ball.
Well, I mean, Pinner is still a...
Pinner, Neasden.
Neasden is where football fans ashen-faced...
Ron Nee, the manager of Neasden Town. Yeah, in Private Eye.
So that's kind of been swallowed up by slightly more low-rent suburbia.
Yes, I suppose to some
Whereas
extent.
Whereas Pinner is...
Pinner is slightly more genteel, isn't it?
Slightly more genteel, but still a bit common, if you're T.S. Eliot.
Well, I think, is it not fair to say that the further you get out of London along the Metropolitan line, the more genteel it becomes?
But every stop on the Metropolitan line is a kind of lightning rod for different shades of British snobbery.
That's
would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
You kind of sneer at different regions for different reasons, you know, different reasons.
Amersham, which I'm sure is absolutely lovely, and in the Chilterns, to a lot of people would just seem middle England, utterly boring, you know, sort of, I think you're absolutely right, Chorley Wood or whatever, all these sort of places. But the one person, of course, who's as it were, an intellectual who champions this ahead of his time, as you said, is John Betjeman. So the funny thing is that Betjeman isn't from Metroland. He grew up in Highgate. But he's writing about it when it's really gone. So they stop using the phrase, the Metropolitan Railway, stop using the phrase in the 1930s. That actually shows you how quickly it's become kind of...
Déclassé.
Yeah, déclassé, exactly. And then once, from the mid-1930s onwards, the Metropolitan Railway basically ceases to exist. It's absorbed into London Transport. It sort of is just to a lot of people, it just seems like a sort of, you know, they forget about it. They forget it ever happened. But Betjeman is writing poems about the line and about the places along the line quite early on. So 1954, he has a poem called Middlesex. I'll just read one verse. Very Betjeman, for people who don't know Betjeman. Gaily into Ruislip Gardens runs the red electric train. With 1,000 tars and pardons, daintily alights a lane. Hurries down the concrete station with a frown of concentration, out into the outskirts' edges, where a few surviving hedges keep alive our lost Elysium, rural Middlesex again. So Betjeman is kind of alive to the vanishing rural nature of it, but he doesn't sneer at the suburbs. He's wry about them, but he sort of takes them seriously at the same time. And then in 1973, when Betjeman has become a national treasure. So he's this sort of cuddly teddy bear, conservationist, poet laureate. The BBC asked him to make a film about Metroland, which he does. So you can see the film online. He gets on the train in London with a guidebook from the 1920s, and he basically just takes the line all the way to the end. I mean, he has this fantastic line. He says, Metroland is a child of the First World War, forgotten by the Second. And off he goes. He starts at Baker Street with this. If you ever got off at Baker Street Station, there's a big kind of classical apartment block above Baker Street called Chiltern Court. So he starts by talking about that. Then he goes to all these places, St. John's Wood, Neasden, Wembley, Harrow, Pinner, Chorley Wood, Amersham. And he goes all the way. And it's this beautiful film, very 70s. Very melancholy, kind of nostalgic. So it's funny watching it because you're watching multiple eras at once. You're watching somebody from the 70s talking about a sort of project from the 1910s and 20s, but which was itself the product of a line that was built in the 1860s.
And also in the 70s, I mean, that's a period where a lot of Victorian and Edwardian architecture is being demolished. So most notoriously, the Euston Arch, which Betjeman was very upset about.
Exactly.
This great neoclassical structure outside Euston Railway Station.
And what's even better, Tom, is that documentary, Metroland, goes out on the BBC, and I think it's February 1973, and if I think I'm right in saying it goes out on the day that it goes out, there's been a rail strike.
Wow,
which is just perfect timing. So he goes all the way along the line. And this is the perfect point for it to end. He goes to Verney Junction in rural Buckinghamshire, which by then has closed. Is no longer. And he goes, and there's nothing there.
Oh.
And the final line of the whole film, he says, grass triumphs, and I must say I'm rather glad. And that's the end.
Brilliant.
So
that's the perfect note on which to end a series about London. So I hope you've enjoyed our London week. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.